Welcome to the Coaches Studio by Animas, the podcast that explores the art and science of coaching. And now, over to your host for the session, Yannick Jacob.
I'm so excited. Julie Starr, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here, Yannick.
For those of the people who might be listening or watching this who have not heard of Julie, Julie has quite an illustrious career. You've been in coaching for a long time. You're leadership coach, your team coach. You do lots of different kinds of coaching. You train coaches. You've written a number of books. Most popular will be Brilliant Coaching, which was, I think, 2008 that came out, quite early.
So
exactly.
I think this is the most popular one that teaches coaches how to coach, the coaching manual.
And
this is the one that's translated into lots of different languages and supports coach training around the world.
Still one of my go-to resources. You also written a coach mentoring manual. So
yes.
You've come prepared. Really, really good resources. You've also were one of the coaches in the Leap coaching movie, which I found super interesting because I got quite excited when I watched that. Especially, you can watch the actual coaching sessions of people, full-length coaching sessions.
Yes.
And a lot of people there were, I would say, very firmly, if not exclusively, in the mentoring spectrum of the helping by talking universe, if we wanted to frame it that. You were one of the coaches who very purely coached, if you can call it like that. So that's part of why I'm interested to talk to you, to explore that kind of intersection and when is which approach helpful? Can there be an integration of sorts?
Sure.
You've also written a novel that I'm going to be curious about. And, you know, such a wonderful way to bring some of these concepts to life. Mm-hmm. So you've done a lot of work. You've been a thought leader in the field for quite some time. Is there something, I mean, there's many more things to you. Is there something that is important to you by means of introduction so people kind of know where you're talking from?
Yeah, I guess the fundamental base for the work that I've been doing for about 25 years in this field has been my own path of self-development and inquiry. So that's what fuels my work, and that's what keeps the work fresh. So I'm always going on a course, an experience. I was on something on Saturday. I would be listening to things. I would be reading things. I'm just doing a kind of deep dive into Carlos Castaneda, which is a really strange realm of, you know, alternate reality. So I kind of go off and do all of these activities, you know, for my own enjoyment, pleasure, my own path of development. And then my work, my writing, the work that my team do to train coaches is a distillation, is that kind of forming practical access to some of the principles and ideas that I found really powerful for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that love for learning, I noticed that as a strength in many, many coaches. And I think it's really fueling excellence if we continue to be on a journey and
certainly acknowledge
that we're always in a process of becoming as coaches, right?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. Mm. It's a journey without end. And there's a saying, isn't there? The more you know, the more you realize you don't know. That's why this appetite to pursue coaching, to maintain a focus on this topic, it never gets dull. You know, for people that are listening, that are just coming into the field, you know, you're struggling immediately with the idea, the concepts, the principles, the underpinning philosophies. You know, you're kind of trying to get your head around it and incorporate that into behavior. After a while, we get this level of competence that then we start to realize, actually, there's so much more to go. You know, the realm of inquiry and self-discovery and awakening, if you like, that comes from being involved in this field. And that's what keeps us all fresh for it and, you know, having the appetite for it, certainly.
Yeah, and there's so many things to explore. It's always evolving. So I wonder, at this point in time, perhaps is probably the best question, how would you frame your coaching? And maybe in contrast to mentoring, or maybe we can bring that in later, but I wonder, how would you put a frame around that?
I'm not sure I can. So as any coach listening, it probably applies exactly the same. My coaching is an expression of my journey and my learning, my experience, the wisdom that I've gained, and that become, you know, to be able to express that authentically in a one-to-one situation where you're creating that context, that's always new. And so it's not, you know, I'm not able to say, oh, I'm this kind of coach and I do a lot of this kind of work, because it's fresh and it's new in every situation. The other thing that I should mention is, by now, I keep a very short list of people that I do one-to-one coaching with, because I'm running a business called Star Coaching. My team develop managers and leaders how to coach in, you know, the, you know, the, to be able to coach as part of a managing and leadership role, because that's where I think a lot of the latent power of coaching philosophy, ideas, behaviors sit, in terms of transforming the way people are with each other and the principles that we operate from in organizations. That's where I think a lot of the potential of coaching ideas and philosophy sits. And we've obviously just built this online learning portal called LearnStar. And so a lot of my occupation is in writing, it's in coaching my team, it's in managing this business and being an entrepreneur and a creative in this new tech environment. And I still maintain a short list of clients that I will coach. And I'm less a kind of jobbing coach that's got, you know, 20 people that I'm coaching at any one time, because I find that potentially overwhelming, and I would sooner partition that and think, okay, I can name everybody I'm coaching. I'm immersed in that situation. You know, I can access information readily about, okay, this person, this person, this person. You know, and it got to a stage a few years ago where I was coaching kind of 20 people at a time, and I couldn't keep track. You know, for me, with running the business, it became too much.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned this is how it expresses itself. I wonder how you express that when you sit with somebody, because you mentioned the knowledge and the experience that you've gained. And I guess that's where we are at the intersection between coaching and mentoring. Because many coaches, particularly in supervision, they come and they say, well, what the client really wanted or what they found particularly valuable was that piece of wisdom or that my opinion on things, or maybe a pointer into a direction of what they could be doing. And I know it's wrong because it's not coaching, but at the same time, it's welcomed and people want that. And some people even expect that. And they found it really helpful and I felt good about it. But now I feel I'm not coaching anymore.
Yeah.
So
So... 2 points. I'd like to relax the word mentoring as it's currently being used in this conversation. So it seems like there's a shorthand to use the word mentoring to indicate when somebody is being directive, when a coach is being directive and telling and advising. And that's not mentoring. So let's not call that mentoring. Mm-hmm. That's a coach being directive. So if we think about a direct, you know, a scale, a line that says, here I'm being directive, I'm telling. Mm-hmm. Here I'm being less directive, or allowing, encouraging someone to be self-directed, I'm using the skills of inquiry to surface insight, to help somebody go inward, to create a different style of conversation where somebody raises their consciousness, their lucidity around a situation, to the point where, you know, this is where, you know, great questioning, using summaries, using observations really helps people. Those are the tools that are forming what you're pointing at and calling coaching. Mm-hmm. And there's a principle that we teach, which is don't let your lack of ability cause you to argue for being directive. So quite often people never learn the full skill of being able to sit completely in a less directive frame. And as you've observed on the Leap movie, I can sit for a day in a less directive frame if I choose to. And I chose to for the Leap session because that's what I wanted to demonstrate. I wanted to demonstrate the power of inquiry. And I wanted to demonstrate how impactful it can be when a coach kind of sits on their hands and simply creates this space where somebody has that ability to relax, to flatten out kind of in the kind of frequency terms to say, okay, I can just be with this. And you will see me doing things like asking the same question a few different ways, even repeating a question, perhaps pointing, giving an observation, which is less directive than telling somebody what to do, but it's more directive than asking the question, or giving a summary again, which is, you know, along this scale, we have something called the stepping stones model that we teach, where we're saying it's not an either or. So it's not ask or tell. There are behaviors that are more or less directive. So silence is the least directive we can be. Asking a question is, it has a directive element to it because you're pointing, but it's less directive because hopefully you're keeping yourself out of the way.
Right.
We have a summary is the next thing, which is a distillation and pointing. You know, you're saying this. I'm excluding some of what you're saying, but you're saying this. An observation is more of me. So I'm taking a chance to say, can I make an observation? I notice you're avoiding speaking about that. And then I can move back into a less directed frame and say, how fair is that? Or I'm wondering what's causing that. So you can kind of slide up and down this scale. Advice is less directive than instruction or tell, but more directive than observation, summary, question, silence. So this flexibility to move up and down, so this is in the Stepping Stones model is in this book, Brilliant Coaching. The dexterity, the flexibility that a coach needs to develop is to traverse up and down this scale. And once they have truly embodied the ability to stay down here, to stay in silence, questioning, summary, observations, then with wisdom, it gives permission sometimes to point more directly or to encourage.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, how do you make those decisions, I wonder? Because that makes a lot of sense. You learn the skills to really hold space. And when it feels right, appropriate, you know, how do you figure out at what point will it be most helpful for somebody to offer more direction rather than holding space?
You do the work. You clean up your own stuff. So a lot of the work that I've done, you know, I've been to India lots and lots of times, and I've done, you know, I've done a lot of work with the ego and a lot of personal development work to clean up my own idiosyncrasies, fixations, you know, need to impress, need to please, need to demonstrate ability, which is all egoic. When you do the work, you know, the self-development work to clean that act up, then it's this idea you get yourself out of the way so you can literally sit in silence. Eckhart Tolle is a good person to begin with because, you know, he's got the formative book, The Power of Now. The Power of Now, thank you. The Power of Now, Stillness Speaks, and then a really good book that looks more directly at the ego called A New Earth. But if I could recommend two out of those three, I'd say The Power of Now and A New Earth. And that helps you realize how busy the mind becomes. So it's a matter of doing the work and having a continual practice that helps you stay centered and grounded and aligned with this stillness that we bring to a conversation. So a practice might be, for me, it's meditation, it's Qigong, it's yoga, it's reflection notes, it's dealing with what's going on with me and processing emotionally what's going on with me and hopefully staying fairly balanced. So not stressed, not clouded, not bringing into a conversation the last thing that just happened or concern about what's going on, but being able to stay centered and grounded so that we can create that space of listening that is a physical, it becomes a physical thing, it becomes a palpable thing, which is demonstrated by feedback that you would get from your clients that you're working with, which is, I can tell you anything, I feel heard. Even though I am a challenging coach and I will point, it's done with compassion and it's done with care. And it's that ability not to jump in, because there's something going on that develops a hesitation that says, so if I have a compulsion, because the mind is a trickster, the mind will try to, especially when we're learning to coach, the mind will track the conversation and it will try and get ahead of the conversation, because when we try to get ahead of the conversation, it takes us into a safety, which is, I know where this is going. I know what they should do. I have come up with the fix for this. I have the idea. I know, which is so the territory of the ego. Mm-hmm. And when you start to become aware of that, so if I have a compulsion to offer something, there's a check that happens, which is that appropriate? Mm-hmm. Let me, yeah. And for me, it's a, you know, you start to learn with your body, which is why body work's so good, because you start to attune to your own physicality. And it's like, I have a physical barometer that says, keep your mouth shut. Don't do this. This is ego. Mm-hmm. This is me trying to look good or trying to impress. Or, I was in a conversation yesterday with a very senior person in a large organization, earning an incredible amount of money. And my fees are not for the faint-hearted. And so there can be a tendency when you start to wrap all of those things up, you're in this amazing glitzy London office, you've got somebody opposite you that is at the top of their game, you know that your fees are parable, you know, in parity with that, there can be a tendency to effort and think, well, I need to prove value, well, I need to do something, well, I need to, and that's all egoic, because there's a concern, which is, well, what if they think I'm rubbish? What if they don't think I'm talking enough? What if they don't think I'm demonstrating my ability, my capability? And you have to, again, get all of that out of the way. And only by able to retain centered and groundedness, which is natural to me, it's a very comfortable place for me to be. You step into a different way of being. And I don't know whether that sounds simple or complicated or accessible or inaccessible, but all I can say is there's a path of your own practice, your own study, mm-hmm. Following your own breadcrumbs in terms of what you're interested in, what feels right for you to go and study, what feels like a passion for you. And then that becomes something you embody and express to others. Yeah. And then that becomes your offering as a coach.
Yes, I think that's so important that you're sharing that, because that's also a journey that's never complete, right? The ego will always come knocking. It's not that at some point you reach some sort of enlightenment and then you have your ego intact and you transcended that. No, it hits us all. And, I remember very clearly still, and I mentioned that very briefly before we started recording, the first time we've met, my ego totally got in the way, because I was invited by the organizer to a conference and I walked up to a free table with a free space and I said, oh, can I sit here? And it was the presenter's table. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then later we had a conversation with the organizer, and I kept saying things to kind of put myself at the level of the presenter, because somebody had invited me and I didn't know anybody there. And I totally got taken away with wanting to prove value of some sort. And you know, I noticed and I walked away from this and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I said this. I can't believe I said that. And it happens in coaching sessions occasionally as well. Yeah. Now less than it used to, you know, but in the beginning it's like, oh, why did I said that? You know, why did I try to offer value here? Why did I try to prove myself, you know, oh, this person has like 20 years more coaching experience. What makes me supervise them? So I have to work extra hard. No, I don't. I need to just really be present with that.
Yeah. So, We've all done that. Mm-hmm. It's human. And there's a principle which is, in a war with the mind will always win. So there is a compassion that we need to develop for ourselves that say, that was a tremendous learning experience. And I got to, you know, the contrast of that and the emotional discomfort of that was so valuable early on. You know, it was like in your face. I saw exactly the game I was playing, and I'm sick of the game, you know, just getting sick of the game. We've all done it. I've done it. You know, I've learned the most by those, you know, super uncomfortable moments. I have them myself. And that, there's an acceleration that comes from that, which is never again. You know, I need to find a different path, a different way. Mm-hmm. It's formative, and we've all had it. It's the journey. It's not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah, and that's why developing a meditative practice or whatever other practice you might call it that helps us to acknowledge and notice what our mind wants to do, what our ego wants to do, and being able to choose to stay present. You know, to not give into that, to not play the game, to not get sucked into something. Such an crucial ability as a coach to develop. So thank you for that. As we are now sitting in the space of presence with a client, again, I still wonder how those decisions are being made, other than an intuitive knowing of, I think this piece of experience, this piece of information I have, the story that I got to tell, or this thing that I could point somebody towards, you know, to consider, not necessarily, or maybe even instruct somebody, you know. So I wonder how you make those decisions in the moment.
There's a few things that kind of help, that assist. So if you notice, so the coach, when you want to really experience effective coach work, it kind of looks effortless. There's a flow to it where the efforting isn't noticeable. Mm-hmm. And that's because the efforting isn't there. There's just poignancy born out of the present moment awareness of the coach. So self-awareness gives that gap of choice. If you notice you're efforting, you know, develop a relaxing capability that just says, okay, just relax. I might have, it could be, you could think of it like an intention or a prayer that comes in a moment, which is, you know, if I get to the awareness, I don't know where to go now. I'm stuck. I think I harness the unconscious or the universal consciousness or something that says, what do I need to serve? You know, what do I need to do to serve, or what's needed here, or what do we need to speak about? And that will be an internal question that starts to, you know, take my mind in a useful direction. And because I've got, you know, thousands of hours of this access, plus my own, you know, regular practice, the answer comes. It's just there. I have this kind of almost auditory thing that just says, we need to go back, we need to check. The other thing that helps is that I do have a framework for the conversation. So it isn't that I turn up, hi, how are you? What would you like to talk about? I have a basic structure. In this book, you'll read something called The Coaching Path, which is a very simple five-step structure, and actually stage one and stage five, people already know how to do, which is introduce a session, complete a session. You know, those aren't difficult. The stage two, stage three, and stage four are what distinguish a coaching conversation. And whilst I might loop around those, that sequence, certainly that helps guide me, because, you know, I'm into a conversation, I'm greeting somebody, I'm letting them let off steam. I might say, you know, is it useful just to download what's happened since I last saw you, so they can go blah, 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 blah. We can both get a sense of what's going on. But then at some point, I'll start to point more directly in terms of what would you like to get from this session? What are the topics we need to cover? So that I've got some sense of where to navigate in the conversation. You know, once you've got those topics, even if you have to throw them away, at least it gives you an initial star to navigate by. So you kind of set up an expectation, a sense of purpose and intention for the conversation, which is, I'd like to talk about this. This seems important. These are the topics. And I might write those down. In fact, I will write those down. We then go into this middle stage, which is where all the coaching behaviors, the coaching skills in terms of asking great questions, listening, making observations, summaries, perhaps giving some encouragement and advice. I call that inquiry, seek to understand. So this is where there's a nice metaphor that I like that belongs to Miles Downey, very experienced practitioner in the field, where he talks about spring-loaded plates. So spring-loaded plates that you might get in a canteen, where you take a plate and the next plate comes up, and then you take a plate and the next plate comes up. Your job as a coach in inquiry is really to start lifting plates. Assuming that those plates are somebody's thoughts, current level of understanding, opinion, ideas, and you just keep lifting plates. So it becomes quite cathartic for the individual, because they get a really good listening to, and they get to answer a question perhaps cosmetically, like, oh, well, that, it's just that. And then you say, okay, so let's have a look at that. What causes that? What's important about that? And they get to unpack it, and they get to go into it. And then you might say, okay, so you've said this. I'm wondering what else seems appropriate to discuss in this area. Well, I guess the relationship with this person is starting to become an influence. So we're going deep. Whereas, and this is why I'm not a fan of the GROW model, because the GROW model has a kind of left to right, you know, it feels like, we do that, then we do that, then we do that, then we do that. And because it has that formula of, well, what's the goal? Well, you know, what's the current reality? Well, what are your options? So what will you do? And you're kind of in it and potentially out of it first. Without this ability to dwell, to be with somebody and go deep and unpack, that then becomes the formative impact on the individual.
I think it depends how we use it. I always, to me, it occurred like initially I thought quite a similar way about the GROW model. And then it occurred to me that depending on how we use it, very often I went quite deep on something and then we're exploring the reality and then we realize we need to go back to the goal, and then the whole goal changes and then we might be in the way forward and then realize, oh, I'm actually not committed to this. So we go back and then we go deeper and we take off another couple of plates. Yeah. So I think it's more versatile than sometimes it gets credit for. But I totally agree with what you're saying, that taking those plates, figuring out what's below. So I wonder, in that process, when you, for example, when you ask what else might be important here, and you have the client brings something up and you have a strong sense that something else seems to be really important here.
Sometimes coaches
find themselves in a position of like, oh, but I want to be client led, but at the same time, I have a strong sense that this is not important here.
So this is when the stepping stone model helps, because we can make an observation. We can say, okay, we seem to be in territory that's moving us away from the original goal and topic for the conversation. Mm-hmm. Can I just check, is this a useful place for us to be talking about right now? And I'm wondering if there's something else. And if there isn't, then let me know. So it kind of gives you that flexibility to offer, make a gentle offer into the conversation and then step back. Mm-hmm. And again, there's a lack of attachment. So ego has attachment. So ego would say, this is garbage. We're not talking about the right thing. He's avoiding talking about his relationship with the chairman or whatever it might be. And we need to talk about the chairman. And the ego will go in feet first rather than, you know, doing it more gently with compassion and finding a way to maintain trust and rapport and challenge at the same time. Mm-hmm. But again, there's a humility that comes from self-work that says, yeah, I'm not going to try and prove this and I'm certainly not going to push it.
Yeah. Do you ever bring that into the session or acknowledge it as part of the session? Some coaches might say, oh, my ego says this, or I'm telling myself this story that we're not talking about the same, the right thing here. No. Or is that an internal process that you just kind of put into your box and stay present?
Yeah, I tend to stay present. I tend to stay present. I might do a quick acknowledgement of, that sounds really amazing and I'd love to talk about it, and let's stay focused, because, you know, if they say, you know, there was an explosion in Biafra, I don't know, I got shot in Iran or whatever, it's like, that sounds amazing. And I think we would be better served, you know, continuing to talk. There is a tendency to get hooked by certain things, and we have to just do that internal check that says, where do I need to be right now?
Oh yeah, the amount of stories that I would have loved to dig into because I was interested in them. And it can be a difficult decision to make, wanting to go with my curiosity and trust where my curiosity leads me. Some of my curiosity is because of my ego and my stuff and what I want to know, you know, and I want to stay committed to being curious about what's going to be helpful to the client. Sometimes that can be a difficult decision to make.
So to return to your distinction between mentoring and coaching, I think it's more helpful to think about being less directive or more directive and developing useful flexibility. And when you are able to stay within the rules of less directive, then occasionally you're able to break the rules. What distinguishes the difference between mentoring and coaching is not that. For me, which is why I ended up writing this book, because
the mentoring manual.
The mentoring manual, because I felt that there was a piece of the jigsaw puzzle missing, and by going back to the ancient archetype of mentoring, what we learn is that the what distinguishes the difference between mentoring and coaching is not at behavioral level. So some mental, you know, coaching skills, and we give mentors coaching skills are fantastic for mentoring.
Oh, yeah.
Because, again, you help people reduce the impact and influence of the ego. You help them understand the distinctions of listening. You help them ask better questions. You help them create better rapport with the people that they're working with. So coaching skills as a package of ability is absolutely fabulous to give to a mentor. However, a mentor relationship is very different from a coaching relationship. And indeed, it's the nature of the relationship rather than the behavior or the skills. It's the nature of the relationship that creates the distinction of this is a different kind of one-to-one relationship. And to give you an example, within a mentor-mentee relationship, if you go back to the ancient archetype and track it back, so if you go back to Homer's Odyssey and look at, you know, mentor and the relationship he was given with a young boy, what you realize is the quality of the relationship includes this dynamic of benevolence and respect. So benevolence on the part of the mentor to the mentee, which means I feel generous towards you, I feel compassionate towards you, I want the best for you, and I want to empower you. And respect on the part of the mentee, the person being mentored, for the mentor, with respect, we automatically get influenced. So if I respect you, I am willing to be influenced by you. And it's that dynamic, that synergy of benevolence and respect that creates the true potential of a mentoring relationship. And if anybody listening starts to consider, if they go back in their past, relationships that they feel have been mentoring relationships, whether it was, you know, an uncle, a friend of the family, a favorite teacher, somebody they used to work with or work for, they will notice that dynamic of benevolence and respect. Mm. And so what distinguishes mentoring from coaching is the nature of the relationship.
Right.
Because within coaching, we do not need benevolence.
Right. That's the one that I thought would be a given with most coaches, that they feel generous towards this other person, that they feel a very positive wanting to help someone. The respect is something that I thought that seems to be tied in with an influence. That seems to be different from the coaching, depending on what our relationship with the respect is. So could you flesh it out a bit more so we understand the nature of that relationship better?
So if you think about most traditional mentoring relationships involve somebody that's perhaps a bit more mature, somebody that has achieved a certain level of experience and even success in a field. Mm-hmm. And in that, they would like to pass something on. So,
right.
they see somebody at a different stage than them. It's a personal thing. They see somebody at a different stage, an earlier stage, needing support. They have affinity with that individual. So I recognize your journey. I have been there. I would love to support you so that you might avoid mm-hmm. some of the traps and mistakes that I did, or I would enjoy, you know, I see your potential. I would love to see you shine. I'm more probably opinionated about you and your situation and your circumstance. And I am also interested to equip you with life skills, with philosophical awareness, with principles to operate from that I have personally learned in my experience and I would like to give you.
Yeah, and this makes a lot of sense, right? Because in my mind, a mentor, the characteristic, the defining characteristic that make them different is that you work with somebody who's on a similar path at a later stage and who therefore can relate to the journey that you're on. I mean, ultimately, everybody's path is unique, but there are parallels when you work in the same space, for example, do the same career. Now, many coaches, because of the way that they market and because of the relationship that somebody has with you when you work in the same space, often coaches find themselves working with people who are in a similar field, on a similar path. And I think at this point, it becomes so tempting to mentor because the client relates to you in that way.
Yes. And we have that. So I work in law firms and we have a situation in law firms where partners, you know, senior partners might get to the end of their twilight of their career and they might leave fairly early. They might leave, at, you know, retire early at 55, thinking that they want to go into coaching. And essentially what they want to do is work within professional services, the law firm environment, to pass back what they think they know, but they're calling that coaching. And actually, that's mentoring. Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. they're often employed by the same firm as they've worked for 30 years. There's nothing wrong with that because in today's environment, people tend not to want to pay fees for mentors. People are more used to paying fees for executive coaches, mm-hmm. but they are less likely to pay fees for, not in all situations, depends on the brand and the level and the kind of profile of the mentor, let's say. But certainly it's kind of just more convenient, easier to call yourself an executive coach. Yeah. But actually there's a lot of context specific advice, experience, guidance being offered by those individuals. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, in the book I talk about, with every adaptation of the core essence of the archetypal mentor role, so going back in time, with every edit, with every adaptation, we corrupt the integrity of the mentor role. And that mentor role is known to us. It's all around us. It's in film, it's in fiction, it's in fable. You know, it's Professor Dumbledore in Harry Potter. It's Mr. Miyagi in The Kung Fu Kid. It's Mary Poppins in...
it's karate.
After Charles.
I think it's an important point. It's karate. It's not Kung Fu.
The Karate Kid. I'm glad you corrected me. It's Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. It's that's the dynamic. And so we know what it looks like in organization, especially where organizations are realizing we need to develop talent, we need to make more of the potential of people, and we need to harness this latent experience and skill level of these, you know, middle-aged senior individuals, and we can do that at low cost. Yeah. So it's a fabulous potential, and that's why it's a growth area.
Oh, yeah.
But then it gets corrupted by, you know, some HR, L&D, ops thing where they say, maybe they could get involved in the performance review cycle, or maybe they could give us feedback on the individuals. Maybe they could help spot the real talent coming through. And that's a corruption of the integrity of the role, because it starts to, if I'm mentoring, it starts to make me think, okay, I'm going to give feedback on this, or I need to, you know, and that's a shame, but that's the contemporary application of mentoring in the workplace.
Yeah, and this is where coaches, mentors, whatever they call themselves, right? Because usually coaches or mentors, or the practitioner cares a lot more about what is being called than the client ultimately cares about.
I
remember I was a bit thrown when the first coach called me a mentor, even though I worked as a supervisor and maybe with a coaching element. I'm like, how do I feel about being a mentor? But then reflecting on that, it's like, yeah, well, that's kind of what I am. I'm a mentor who uses mainly coaching abilities, right?
Yes.
With time, allowing myself to put stuff on the table and sharing information, just as you kind of described in the beginning, that makes a lot of sense to me because of the nature of the relationship. It's undeniable that there's an element of that. But it's interesting that there's so much stigma there, and people don't want to, but then ultimately the coaches care the most about what they call it. And they spend so much time,
justifying
and agonizing over what is the thing that I call myself, when the client just wants help.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. We have to remember that coaching, we haven't invented coaching. What we've done is, you know, it's been around as, you know, since Socrates started asking people interesting questions in the street. It's what we've done with the coaching field, which is very useful, is we have wrapped and packaged, we have grouped behaviors, principles, skills, and given them this brand that we call coaching. You know, when we go into organizations and teach managers and leaders these skills, sometimes we let go of the word coaching and we call them conversational skills. You know, we talk about asking better questions. We talk about facilitating other people, you know, to think and act for themselves. We drop the term so that it doesn't have a label, that we're simply talking about better listening, better questioning, building rapport, you know, being able to give constructive feedback, and how to structure, you know, we give people a structure of a conversation for doing that. And that can be really useful because people recognize after a while, these are not only conversational skills, these are life skills. You know, this presupposition that somebody might be able to think and act for themselves, and that it's a useful thing sometimes to empower them by encouraging them to do that. You know, we get this idea of rather than just throwing fish at people, we teach a man to fish, which is, you know, when a manager realizes actually, I'm overwhelmed and I don't take a holiday because people just want me all the time and they won't move without calling me to make sure, you know, it becomes a parent-child relationship rather than an adult relationship. And when you can start to give them these things that you and I are calling coaching skills, then that helps them perceive a different level of value that they can add by creating the context by which other people are successful.
Right.
And our humanness creates, you know, has real gratification, a sense of real appreciation of doing that. We love to do that. You know, it's in our nature. We love to help people thrive. We love, you know, we love to create that context where other people are successful and see them shine. It's wonderful. There's nothing better.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this interesting spectrum from like healing to navigating to thriving to transformation, right? And that transformation bit is what I'm really curious about and what we hear in the podcast are really curious about. So I'm almost keen to explore different people's perspectives on that because it's quite blurry as a space out there. Kind of Nick's making sense of this in a really interesting way at the moment. But I wonder what your take on transformation is, because within these journeys, a lot of transformation arguably takes place as we're going through this process of either mentoring or coaching. So I wonder what are your thoughts on that? How do you see that? How do you see people transform?
I think it's a risky term to use. And it's a risky term to use because we live in this fast culture where we want it now, it's immediate, we think we've got it, we grab it, I've got that. Oh yeah, I understand that, I've got that. And of course, human growth, change, takes time. It takes time. It can be a bit like a pregnancy. No matter how much resource and time and effort you throw at it, it's going to take 9 months, or it's going to take 12 months, or it takes, you know, some of the greatest shifts in people's perception, not perception so much as demonstrable behavioral change, happens after most of the coaching has happened. So I tend to work on a vanilla assignment of 6 + 1 session. And by that, I mean, I'll deliver 6 sessions and then I'll leave somebody. I might leave them 10 months, even a year. And when we go back, because the pressure of the coaching is off, because they've been able to assimilate it, because they've been able to integrate things more naturally into their day-to-day existence, suddenly they realize nothing's the same. They don't feel the same about who they are. They don't believe their role as a leader and manager in the organization. You know, they recognize their contribution is essentially different. What people tell them is that they've changed shape, that they probably relax more, that they offer, you know, you have this kind of less is more. People just sit back into who they are and access the real power of who they are, rather than this efforting, busyness, control, dominate my situations, become stressed and overwhelmed by my situations, try and fix everything. You know, when you start to help people lean back into a more considered sense and, you know, and helping them calibrate, when do I need to step forward? When do I need to step back? Then things start to transform. You know, it's a bit like we talk about, you know, altering the direction of an oil tanker by a few degrees. You're not going to see a notice in a day, 2 days, 3 days, but within 6 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, 12 months, you are in a completely different destination.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a difficult thing to convince clients on, because there's an immediacy that they want. They want to see behavioral shifts.
Yeah.
And certainly sometimes we can accelerate that. But actual transformation, I like the term less, because it indicates the coach's job is to rub somebody out and draw them again. And my job, the sense of purpose I have, is to help people let go of all those things that they thought they were supposed to be in order for the true sense of themselves to emerge and the real access to power that comes from that. And yes, there might be skills, there might be, you know, language patterns, there might be things that I can teach them about body and posture and all those things that help them embody that. But actually, it feels like almost a reduction exercise rather than putting a jacket and a hat and a scarf on somebody to say, right, you've got all of this other stuff now that you can do.
Outside in.
Yeah, it's inside out. That's the work I'm interested in doing. It's deep work and it's inside out. And it can feel therapeutic for somebody. And it's, I started work with a new client yesterday and I could tell by the end of it, he was fatigued. He was, he was kind of exhausted in a good way. It had been a kind of conversation he wasn't used to having about himself. He was super happy to have had it, but it wasn't, we didn't go away with a list of 10 things to do, which is fix that, buy that, have these three conversations, get on top of these projects, hire another PA. It wasn't that level of behavioral change. It was the poignancy of the self-reflection that says, flip, I need to think about this now. I need to really think about who I am and what I'm up for doing. It's a deeper level of inquiry.
Oh, yeah. So I want to use that last bit of time that we have, as we touched on outside in and inside out. You wrote that novel. I haven't read it, I must admit, but I'm super curious about it, because as an existentialist, a lot of the ideas were probably best made tangible for people through plays and stories.
So
could you tell us a bit more about the story you've written?
So it's a book for young adults, but it's what's called a crossover book. So like Harry Potter or The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas or whatever, Life of Pi, things like that. It's focused on young adults, but it's an adult level of conversation, so adults can read it. It's called From Magic
to Memphis.
And the subtitle is What If Your Life Is Working From the Inside Out? And it's based in the US. It's about a young, talented musician who is angry. She's hostile. She's run away from home. She's estranged from her mother and her sister. She wants to make it big in the music industry, but she has this internal conflict. She gets angry. She gets into arguments and disputes. She loses her job in a record store. She gets kicked out of the band. The trailer burns down. And during all of this, and she lives with just this fighting dog, this pit bull terrier called Bear for company.
Oh, he's on the cover.
He's on the cover. So he's kind of like her shadow. And she meets a mentor along the way. And it's somebody that she just runs into in a coffee shop, and he has this strange conversation with her about how, there's an everyday magic we can access, but as children, we throw away the idea of magic with the Easter Bunny and Father Christmas and all that good stuff. We throw it away and we don't expect any magic or synchronicity to happen anymore. And he leaves a card on the table, and on one side there's a feather, and on the other side it just says, what if your life is working from the inside out? And the premise is, what's going on inside of us is showing up outside of us. So for her, she's angry, she's hostile, she's resentful. And that's what she's getting. She's experiencing a lot of conflict. And of course, he keeps showing up at different points and just kind of pointing to her about how she is the source of her own experience. And that what she realizes through the trajectory of the narrative, the plot, that she ends up in Memphis in this music contest. What she realizes is that when she shifts, the external world starts to shift. So people, you know, when she starts being less aggressive, less hostile, more open, perhaps a little bit more vulnerable, seeking connection with people, then people step forward and then she starts to receive help and then things start to go better. So there is this, it is a kind of coming of age novel, but it's also, it was an opportunity for me to put a lot of the ideas of emotional maturity and kind of life skills in, you know, and kind of awareness perspectives on life that we can draw upon that will help life shape more comfortably, successfully, smoothly around us. So I loved writing the book. It was it's a complete joy. I've got another one in manuscript form called The Truth Keeper that will be the next one on the shelf.
What's that going to be about?
It's about a young girl who inherits the ability to know the truth in any moment. I like this. As I say, you know, to go back to the original point, what fuels my work is my own self study, personal development experiences, you know, 8 or 9 trips to India in 8 or 9 years, you know, going on lots of things that stimulate my thought about what, you know, what causes us to be happy, successful and fulfilled in our own terms. Writing novels gives me an opportunity to put that in more of an accessible form, especially for young adults.
Yeah, such an important reminder that when we are in relation with someone, we bring ourselves in. If we want to or not,
right?
We can try to be clean and leave our egos at the door.
Yeah.
But if we're not aware of it, they're going to find their way into the relationship either way. So thank you for this reminder.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. It's all about the story of ourselves, isn't it? When we change the story of ourselves. Wayne Dyer has a lovely saying, which is, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's inside out.
Yeah, or what I like this, same thing, right? Things are exactly as you think they are.
Yeah. Totally.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Great. Julie, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're very welcome.
If there anything you wanted to let coaches know, there's very experienced coaches listening to this. There's a lot of new coaches listening to this.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's some sort of message you wanted to get out into the coaching ether.
Yeah, what I would like to tell people is we built this thing called LearnStar. So my surname obviously has 2 R's, LearnStar.com. And on LearnStar.com, you know, we are teaching managers and leaders how to coach. We're also starting to build masterclasses, coach practice events, things that are shorter, easy access for new coaches, more experienced coaches, all the free downloads from both the coaching manual that, you know, things that help people to practice coaching and the mentoring manual that help people practice mentoring. The free downloads are available on that site. This year, this is the book for managers and leaders that teaches managers and leaders how to coach as part of their role.
This is brilliant coaching, just for the people who are listening.
Brilliant. Oh, sorry. Yes, brilliant coaching. This will be revised this year, and I'm going to do some free downloads for that. I like to do free downloads. And this brilliant coaching is also available in Audible on Audible. So, please, you know, if anybody is interested in working with us, those are the access points. And obviously there's my corporate website, which is called Star Coaching, which shows more about the work we do in organizations.
Star, double L, don't get starstruck, although this is probably the only way, is a really, really good thing to get starstruck. By the way, if you needed some more convincing, people like Stephen Covey, Marshall Goldsmith, Sri Carter Scott, who we had in the podcast recently, they're all endorsing your book. So there's a lot of value there. I can recommend them. Julie, thank you so much for your service to the coaching and mentoring profession,
welcome.
Industry. Way of being. So I appreciate what you do, and please keep doing it for a very long time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Yannick.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To watch these episodes on video, make sure you also check out youtube.com/animascoaching. See you back here soon.